have to get my Lake Magog vaccine.
Your Lake Magog vaccine?
Yeah, you know, I'm really looking forward to having the whole family to the cottage for my annual cookout.
Smart move. I'm gonna ask for the Montreal vaccine. I miss those last-minute get-togethers with my buddies.
Nice. Well, I gotta run. I don't think it protects against lateness.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Toi, ton vaccin, tu l'as eu?
Non, encore, mais ça va pas tarder.
Et tu l'as pris pour quoi?
J'ai pris le vaccin danse.
Le vaccin danse? Trop bonne idée.
Ouais, m'entraîner avec les filles, c'est ce qui me manque le plus.
Ben moi, le mien, ça va être le vaccin soccer. Je suis vraiment impatiente de retrouver toute la gang.
La vaccination nous rapproche de tous ces moments. Suivez la séquence de vaccination prévue dans votre région et prenez rendez-vous à québec.ca/vaccin-COVID. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
After weeks of speculation, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has postponed next month's parliamentary elections, which would have been held for the first time in 15 years in the occupied territories. Abbas said the delay was caused by Israel's refusal to promise that thousands of Palestinians living in Israeli-occupied areas of Jerusalem could vote in the election. The decision comes at a time when a rift is growing within the Fatah party. Well, earlier this week, Human Rights Watch released a major report saying for the first time that Israel's committing crimes of apartheid and persecution in the occupied Palestinian territories. The International Human Rights Group says Israeli authorities have dispossessed, confined, and forcibly separated Palestinians. Human Rights Watch concluded, quote, "The Israeli government has demonstrated an intent to maintain the domination of Jewish Israelis over Palestinians across Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories." Human Rights Watch also released this video alongside its report.
Apartheid. While many associate the word with South Africa, apartheid is a universal legal term that refers to severe discriminatory oppression. Apartheid is also a crime against humanity. Its definition in the 1973 Apartheid Convention and the 1998 Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court is made up of three key elements: an intent to maintain the domination by one racial group over another, systematic oppression by one racial group over another, and one or more inhumane acts as part of that oppression. Persecution is a crime against humanity under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. It is made up of two primary elements, a discriminatory intent leading to severe deprivation of fundamental rights of a racial, ethnic, or other group. On the basis of these definitions and its research, Human Rights Watch finds that Israeli authorities are committing the crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution. Human Rights Watch finds that the elements of the crimes come together in the occupied Palestinian territory, pursuant to an Israeli government policy to maintain the domination by Jewish Israelis over Palestinians across Israel and the occupied territory. In the occupied territory, that intent has been coupled with systematic oppression and inhumane acts committed against Palestinians living there. The Israeli government is the main authority across Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory. In these areas, Israeli officials have demonstrated a discriminatory intent to maintain domination over Palestinians by ensuring control over land and demographics by Jewish Israelis. Take the Jerusalem municipality as an example. The Israeli authority's goal is to maintain a sizable Jewish majority by boxing in Palestinian areas while helping predominantly Jewish areas to flourish. Israeli authorities maintain a two-tier system which privileges Jewish Israelis over Palestinians. The means used by Israeli authorities in the occupied territory amount to the systematic oppression needed to establish the crime of apartheid. Israeli authorities have committed a range of abuses against Palestinians. In the occupied territory, those abuses include mass land confiscation, the denial of residency rights, and the suspension of civil rights, and rise to the threshold of inhumane acts and severe abuses of the fundamental rights of Palestinians. The international community should recognize the reality on the ground for what it is and press the Israeli authorities to end apartheid and persecution.
That's a new video by Human Rights Watch issued this week. It comes as Israel is being hailed around the world for vaccinating 60% of its population, the highest percentage in the world, but only 3% of Palestinians are vaccinated. On Tuesday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked about the Human Rights Watch report on Israeli apartheid.
As to the question of whether Israel's actions constitute apartheid, that is not the view of this administration.
Well, for more, we're joined by Omar Shakir, Israel and Palestine director at Human Rights Watch, lead author and researcher for their groundbreaking new report called A Threshold Crossed, Israeli Authorities and the Crimes of Apartheid and Persecution. Omar, welcome back to Democracy Now! Start off by talking about the research you did into this and the significance of Human Rights Watch using, for the first time officially, the term apartheid when looking at how Israel is dealing with the Palestinians.
Thank you for having me, Amy. We spent over 2 years conducting the research for this report. What we tried to do is to connect the dots behind years of Human Rights Watch research. We've been working on Israel and Palestine for more than three decades, as well as look at new case studies we conducted for this report and review Israeli government planning documents, statements by officials, and other materials. When we looked at all the evidence, we then compared it against established law on discrimination, including the universal prohibition on severe discriminatory oppression and the crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution, as described in the video. When we did so, we reached the conclusion that Israeli authorities are committing the crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution. The report is entitled A Threshold Crossed because for years, prominent voices have warned that apartheid lurked just around the corner. But it's very clear that that threshold has been crossed. It well may have been crossed years ago, but without doubt, that corner has been turned. And it's time for the international community to recognize the reality on the ground for what it is, apartheid and persecution, and take the steps necessary to end a situation of this gravity.
And Omar, what would be those steps?
We list several steps on the international community's table that they should take immediately as a result of this report. First is for the International Criminal Court to investigate and prosecute these crimes, as well as for national courts to do so under the principle of universal jurisdiction. We call for the issuance of targeted sanctions, including asset freezes and travel bans, against those Israeli officials implicated in the crime. We call for all states, including the United States, to condition all arms sales and military humanitarian security assistance on Israeli authorities on taking steps to end apartheid and persecution. We call on all countries to evaluate its engagement with Israel to ensure non-complicity in the crimes, including bilateral agreements. And of course, to get to all these steps, step number one is to call a thing by its name, to call a spade, to recognize that the reality we face on the ground today is not merely a temporary occupation, depriving millions of Palestinians of their fundamental rights solely because of who they are, speaks to a larger policy, a policy to privilege one people at the expense of another. A 54-year occupation is not temporary. A 30-year peace process will not dismantle systematic repression. What's needed is an entire new paradigm shift that's rooted in the protection of human rights and accountability.
What do you make of the White House spokesperson Jen Psaki's response saying, we just don't share the view, she was saying, of Human Rights Watch?
I think the reality is it's going to take time, of course, for the international community to, you know, grapple with this reality on the ground. Human Rights Watch by no means is the first organization to make this assessment. Palestinians have been describing their lived experience as apartheid for years, if not decades. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem reached a conclusion earlier this year. Other prominent commentators have been talking about apartheid as a hypothetical, but yet the international conversation is so steeped in these assumptions around the peace process and the temporary nature of abuse that they're not going to be undone overnight. So I think a big part of the challenge incumbent upon us now is to really call on folks to understand and speak out to the reality for what everybody sort of knows, you know, is the case, and then to take the steps necessary. So I'm not surprised that the U.S. government, which has been deeply, you know, involved, obviously, in supporting Israeli government policies, is not yet ready to make that jump. I am encouraged, you know, that the statement, was constructive in the sense, if you look at the larger picture, of wanting to look more in depth at the report and its findings. We hope the U.S. government and other governments will do so, and we look forward to engaging them on the report and its recommendations.
Omar Shakir, can you comment on what's happening in the occupied territories with Palestinians' access to vaccines? Israel is being hailed around the world as the country that has vaccinated the highest percentage of its population, more than 60%. But we're talking about, well, according to Haaretz in the last day, 3% of Palestinians have been vaccinated. Talk about the situation and who is responsible here.
Absolutely. Look, today, between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, you have one government, the Israeli government, that primarily rules over these areas where about 6.8 million Jewish Israelis and 6.8 million Palestinians live. And when it comes to vaccines, the Israeli government has vaccinated the vast majority of Jewish Israelis. And when it comes to the 6.8 million Palestinians, they have vaccinated Palestinian citizens who make up the majority of those who make up, you know, about 1.5, 1.6 million people, as well as Jerusalem residents. But they have largely not vaccinated the 4.7 million Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip who live under Israeli rule. This creates a dynamic in parts of the West Bank where on one side of the road, you have people who are receiving a vaccine because they're Jewish and people on the other side of the road who are not receiving a vaccine because they're Palestinian. It really sort of boils down to that, where you can have a 25-year-old Jewish Israeli settler who is eligible for a vaccine, you know, while a 47-year-old Palestinian man who may have health conditions has yet to receive it. The Israeli government, of course, says that this is the responsibility of the Palestinian, you know, authority. But the law of occupation is quite clear that an occupying power has the duty to ensure medical supplies, including those needed to combat a pandemic, to the occupied population. And of course, that obligation is heightened in the context of a half century occupation where the Israeli government has developed a sophisticated machinery to rule over Palestinians, yet seeks to offload the responsibilities to the health of the population, seeking rather only to control the land and to ensure that Jewish Israelis living in this territory are fully integrated, part of the system in Israel, while Palestinians are stuck. Living in a situation of deep systemic oppression. And this dynamic very much is at the heart of the finding of apartheid and persecution that Human Rights Watch reached.
Omar Shakir, you are the Israel and Palestine Director for Human Rights Watch. We're speaking to you in Amman, Jordan. You were expelled by Israel. Have you ever been allowed back? And what is Israel's treatment of human rights observers in the occupied territories?
The Israeli government indeed did deport me in November of 2019. They made clear, and the Supreme Court upheld an interpretation of their law of entry that found that I fell afoul as a result of my human rights advocacy, both before I joined Human Rights Watch, as well as my work at Human Rights Watch. As a result of that determination, I'm unable to return to Israel and Palestine to cover human rights abuses, to do my job on the ground. Of course, the treatment that I've received, I think, speaks to Israel's larger treatment of human rights defenders. Of course, Palestinian human rights defenders face it the worst. Israeli human rights defenders also face significant restrictions. To give one other example, a Palestinian staff member of Amnesty International, Leith Abu Ziyad, has, since 2019 faced a travel ban by the Israeli authorities on unspecified security grounds. He was not able to visit his mother in a hospital in Jerusalem, 3 kilometers from his home, as a result of this travel ban, where she was receiving chemotherapy. She passed away. He has challenged this decision with Amnesty International in the Israeli court system, and they have ruled against him based on secret evidence. And he wasn't even able to attend his court hearing as a result of the travel ban. Palestinian human rights defenders have faced criminal charges. They've faced other sorts of restrictions. Israeli groups have been maligned. Human rights defenders internationally have been denied entry. This is a reality today. The Israeli government not only continues its systematic rights abuse, but muzzles those who speak out and document those abuses.
I wanted to ask you about the latest news that happened overnight. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas postponing next month's parliamentary elections, the first in 15 years in the occupied territories, blaming Israel for refusing to promise that thousands of Palestinians living in the Israeli occupied areas of Jerusalem could vote in the election. This is what he said.
Facing this difficult situation, we decided to postpone the date of holding legislative elections until the participation of Jerusalem and its people is guaranteed. Jerusalem will not be compromised, and our people in Jerusalem will not give up their right to exercise their democratic rights.
Abbas's decision comes at a time when there is a growing rift within his Fatah party. After the jailed Palestinian leader Marwan Barghouti recently endorsed a rival slate to challenge candidates backed by Abbas. Your comments.
Look, I mean, there's two separate issues here. One is absolutely East Jerusalem under international law is a part of the occupied Palestinian territory. And of course, its residents should have the right to vote in elections for the Palestinian Authority. The reality is, while Israel has annexed, this area, the vast majority of the world do not accept that annexation. It doesn't change the status of that territory. And of course, the majority of Palestinians there don't vote in national Israeli elections, many of whom are stateless, without any sort of permanent, stable legal status and face these restrictions. But more, I think more to the point here, this really is pretext. Human Rights Watch has documented for years now the increasingly authoritarian trend of the Palestinian Authority, as well as Hamas authorities in the Gaza Strip. We've documented systematic arbitrary arrest and torture of critics and opponents over recent years, the increasing role security services have in making decisions. And it was quite clear, as you noted, Amy, that there were challenges to Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas's rule, even within the Fatah party. And I think many see this move as, being done out of concern that this election, which all along was being set up to, not really to offer Palestinians a viable chance to change and vote their conscience, but really as a rubber stamp, not only for the PA in the West Bank, but Hamas, in Gaza. But when that was threatened, they canceled elections. It's an unfortunate reality. Palestinian authorities, as they are, manage affairs in only a small part of the entire, occupied Palestinian territory. Israeli authorities retain overarching control. But of course, we can't separate the PA's, repression of critics and dissidents and more general ineffective rule from the larger oppression Palestinians face, including apartheid and persecution at the hand of Israeli authorities. Palestinians are stuck between two authorities, both of whom have engaged in different forms of oppression, both of whom are holding them back from the realization of their full rights.
And finally, Omar, this latest news, at least 44 ultra-Orthodox Jews dying, dozens injured after a stampede during a religious gathering, a pilgrimage, an estimated 100,000 people gathered at Mount Meron late Thursday. Stampede occurred in the early hours of Friday morning after some appeared to slip on stones leading to a sloped passageway, triggering what one local news site described as a human avalanche. Warnings have been issued over the years saying the site was not safe for mass gatherings. This was one of the first major gatherings with COVID restrictions being lifted.
It's an absolute tragedy. And I think, you know, we've seen, I think, over the last year in the wake of COVID, sort of the challenges that the Israeli government has had in dealing with some of the gatherings, you know, of more religious Jewish Israeli communities across the country. You know, this is the sort of thing that was warned about from some of the reporting that's come out from inside Israel, that watchdogs had warned that this scenario was possible. You know, during the pandemic, we saw, of course, examples of gatherings of different religious communities that that the government, you know, sort of attributed to the rise of cases in particular areas. So it's very clear that there are important issues here, and that the Israeli government, whether or not it's formed in the coming days and weeks, or whether or not we head back to elections, these are the sort of things that fall by the wayside as, you know, politicians go back to back in rounds of elections. So it's a really terrible tragedy. You know, obviously the condolences of many in the world go out to the victims. You know, really awful human stories that are coming out. You know, one that I read earlier today of a young boy who was being put in a body bag while his mother was calling him, really awful, avoidable tragedy. And I hope the Israeli government will take steps to ensure this doesn't happen again.
Omar Shakir, I want to thank you for being with us, Israel and Palestine director at Human Rights Watch. We'll link to your report, A Threshold Crossed, Israeli Authorities and the Crimes of Apartheid and Persecution. Omar speaking to us from Amman, Jordan.
Palestine is one of the most reported places in the world.
But there's still a lot of misinformation about the reality on the ground.
What much of the media fails to explain
is that since 1948, nearly 75% of the entire indigenous Palestinian population
have been forcibly driven off our land
to make room for the creation of the so-called State of Israel.
And we are denied the right to return to our homeland.
The remaining 25% of Palestinians live as second-class citizens in the State of Israel, or under a brutal military occupation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
While world powers fund and support Israel,
we,
the people of the world, in our millions,
support the Palestinian people's struggle for freedom and equal rights.
If I boycott Israeli goods, if I boycott Israeli goods,
it's because I oppose an illegal occupation.
Because I oppose racism. Because I oppose brutality towards the indigenous people of a land. I reject the notion that I am anti-Semitic.
I reject the notion I'm a self-hating Jew, simply because I oppose the idea of an exclusively Jewish state.
There is only one line of division.
It's not a line of division between Muslims and Jews.
It's not a line of division between Palestinians and Israelis.
It is a line of division.
It is a line of division.
It is a line of division between those who stand for the equality of all
and those who stand for the supremacy of some. Boycott apartheid.
Boycott Israel.
Boycott apartheid.
Boycott Israel.
Boycott apartheid. Boycott Israel.
Yeah. Welcome to the Mondo Weiss Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Reed. At Mondo Weiss, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. On university and college campuses across the United States and Canada, student activists are organizing for Palestinian liberation under the banner of Students for Justice in Palestine, or SJP. As the student-led movement has grown dramatically over the last 20 years, so has anti-Palestinian pushback from Zionist groups and their allies. Organizations like Canary Mission, StopAntisemitism.org, and other similar right-wing groups have focused a lot of their attention on the student activists of SJP. Despite this, the movement on campuses is strong and shows little signs of slowing down. Earlier this year, the National Students for Justice in Palestine organization held its 10th annual conference. In today's episode, Michael Aria speaks with three SJP activists about how the movement has grown over the last 10 years and where it is headed in the future.
SJP was started in the early 90s, but it holds its first national conference at Columbia in 2011. Can you talk about the motivation and the impetus behind holding that first initial conference in 2011, please?
So at this point, SJPs were run autonomously. We were just really organizing as individual chapters on our campuses and didn't have a national body or institution that could provide support to us in our unique organizing environments. We had been meeting up with each other at conferences across the country that were put on by various organizations, whether they were Palestine focused or just, you know, social justice conferences. And at that point, decided that we really needed something that could support students on a national level. So we could, you know, share skills, so we could develop ourselves politically. And so at that point, we decided to host the first conference at Columbia, and that's where it all started. And it was a really great opportunity for us to connect with each other, for us to learn from each other. It was a very exciting time.
I was reading some of the articles about that first conference, including in our own archives at Mondo Weiss. And a week before that conference, the ADL put out a report for referring to SJP as one of the top anti-Israel groups in the country, and warned that the organization was growing. There was a counter protest at that first conference, and we've seen obviously a lot of resistance to SJP and groups like SJP since. Can you speak about the kind of resistance that you got over that first conference? And I'm wondering whether it was mainly from pro-Israel groups on campus or coordinated attacks from larger organizations like the ADL.
It was a little bit of both. We did certainly face on-campus pressure and resistance, but truthfully, the worst of it came from off-campus organizations like the ADL, as you mentioned. You know, that list came out. But we also had other, you know, we had blogs written about us. We had national organizations coming after us. And there were also members of the community in New York City, you know, folks who were older, not students, coming out to protest us in person. They were carrying signs that were really terrible, really racist. And it was, awful, but it wasn't anything we hadn't seen before. I mean, if you do organizing for Palestinian freedom, you're used to people attacking you, unfortunately, for your principles. So it wasn't great, but it's something that we've become prepared for and are still committed to what we're doing because we know it's the right thing to do.
We've seen the BDS movement grow in popularity in recent years on campus, especially, but we've also seen a more aggressive anti-BDS movement. Can you speak to some of the challenges that SJP has faced on that level?
To get to that point, 2011, where I was a grad student, and it was just sort of without question, nearly every SJP, you know, wanted to support the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. It was really great to see how much the student movement had embraced this call. At the same time, we have definitely been dealing with a lot of pushback. Students who organize on campus, many of them have had successful divestment campaigns, but now they don't know where to go next because a lot of times the administration or there's a board of trustees, they won't be able to take the next step because of that opposition on campus. Off campus, of course, we see BDS legislation and demonization of BDS at the political level by elected officials. So, you know, there's, of course, a lot of manipulation of what BDS is actually about, right? Like, if we think about movements like defunding the police or divestment from South Africa, you know, it's this very basic principle, right? Like, we pay taxes or we pay tuition dollars and we should have a say in where that money goes. And we don't want to be supporting human rights violations with our dollars. But of course, there's so many elected officials who try to make BDS something it's not. So, you know, while I'm hopeful by hopeful about all of the mass grassroots support for the BDS movement, I'm also worried about the pressure that a lot of folks are facing when they take on these campaigns, and, you know, hoping that we can get to a place where more and more people see it for what it is, that it's a grassroots movement for freedom.
Thanks again for chatting with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
I wanted to ask you to start. You, I mentioned you were an SJP member from 2015 until recently. I'm wondering if you saw any changes in how the group was perceived or what kind of resistance you faced from the time you joined until more recently when you left. And I was also wondering if anything changed in terms of the resistance you were getting after Trump was elected, since you were there right before he came into office.
First, thanks for talking with me. Great to be able to speak about this. You know, like, first thing to name is that, you know, repression, surveillance, harassment of Palestine solidarity organizers and their communities is an ongoing issue. And it, you know, wasn't ameliorated with the rise of Trump and the, you know, subsequent sort of liberal hand-wringing at the height of his campaign. So, you know, in that regard, many SJPs had to move in ways that sort of highlighted the, you know, the violence of our so-called democratic institutions on either side of the aisle. It served as an opportunity to build and collaborate with other leftist and progressive issues and movements, you know, seizing the moment by saying, hey, Zionism is violent too. And, you know, white supremacy is a boot on the necks of people outside of the imperial core. You know, my local SJP at the University of Georgia, for example, really quickly mobilized alongside other organizations to establish like a formal coalition made up of community and campus organizations, unabashedly embraced anti-Zionism and, you know, more broadly anti-settler colonialism as one of its principles. And so this really forced self-identified liberals to, you know, reckon with the fact that exceptionalization of Palestine is at odds with the principles that they claim to uphold. Sort of in response to our mobilization, my SJP actually ended up losing its funding after being withdrawn from its departmental membership, which it had actually maintained since it was first founded, maybe like 2004, 2005. That was on the local level. And then sort of on the national level, although noting his many shortcomings on Palestine, Bernie Sanders' campaign also sort of represented a significant shift in the national conversation, you know, owing to the work of organizers who pushed him on it, you know. And similarly, with the launch of the Movement for Black Lives' platform in 2016, expressing solidarity with the Palestinian people, it, you know, drew the ire of liberal Zionists across the country who, you know, as I mentioned before, were forced to grapple with, you know, some serious cognitive dissonance. So there was a lot of anti-Blackness that spilled out of that situation. We saw the rise of Canary Mission around that time, 2015, 2016, which has, you know, had varied levels of activity since then. So the repression intensified in some ways, definitely, but it was also a period of renewed strength and commitment to the work, I think, for us. So, you know, Trump's pro-Israel policies inflamed the situation. And even National SJP, you know, we were sort of faced with a situation where following the defunding of UNRWA, we had to deal with the fact that people were understandably redirecting their support to other groups and efforts on the ground to sort of fill that newly created gap. It was an opportunity, and it was also sort of a period of, you know, heightened repression as well.
Can you speak about some of the campaigns that the group was part of at the University of Georgia while you were a member? And then also, I'm just wondering maybe some of the success stories that things you're able to accomplish in that time.
Following the sort of like defunding of our chapter, you know, we had to sort of move in ways that would not deplete our resources. Our funding was minimal, but, you know, we had to move in ways that would sort of, you know, strike a balance between overdoing it, and we needed to sort of continue to maintain our stability and our, you know, standing as an organization. We had to be careful to not burn out, because, you know, oftentimes you see in SJPs, their membership usually, like, you know, pays from their own pockets. That was the case for us. We didn't quite engage in any particular campaigns, but we certainly sort of did heighten our participation in direct action. One organization, for example, Reservists on Duty, is an organization which brings occupation soldiers to tour across college campuses in the U.S. and I think Canada. And so, you know, we engaged in, you know, some disruption of them. And that was actually following our first disruption. That was when funding was pulled from us. You know, we were hearing things about administration being contacted, and then subsequently, you know, having departments withdraw their sponsorship of an event that we were hosting, for example. You know, but other organizations, other chapters engaged in, you know, there were a lot of divestment campaigns across the country in different regions. On the national level, it's not a campaign, but our annual conference, I think, for National SJP, you know, we had the most widely attended conference in our history in 2018 at UCLA. For many years, you know, NSJP ran the Right to Education Tour, which was developed through a partnership with Brazet University. We brought Palestinian students to college campuses in the U.S. to speak about their experiences under apartheid and occupation. And, you know, that's been a piece of our work for sure. And in part owing to sort of the fact that National SJP was and is a non-hierarchical organization, we don't claim oversight or power over individual Palestine solidarity groups on college campuses, which is something that not many folks know. So, you know, we've historically not been engaged in coordinating campaigns on the local level. You know, oftentimes that work is up to chapters, and we're there to support them with resources and trainings. So, you know, some might see the work that Zionists do on campuses, like, I mean, bringing camels to their plazas and sending in, you know, violently racist state-sponsored initiatives and orgs like Hasbara Fellowships and Reservists on Duty and Students Supporting Israel, you know, bringing them all year round. And then folks might ask, you know, why aren't we doing that? And so it can feel really, really daunting, but we have done and continue to do so much with so little. And it's, you know, it's really a testament to people power, you know, like, you know, capital is not going to save Zionism. It's, you know, National SJP has no headquarters or anything, and virtual and remote work has always been our game. So 2020 was really an opportunity for us to be super intentional about building relationships with movements and groups doing incredible work across the country and around the world. You know, we've hosted panels and webinars, trainings, run different initiatives with Palestinian Youth Movement, Red Nation, Anakbayan, USCPR, Jewish Voice for Peace. I could go on, you know. So we're definitely growing, and the path towards freedom, you know, is ever closer.
Finally, I wanted to ask you, and you've already alluded to it a little in that response, but if you could speak to how cross-campus activism works within the organization. I know you have the conference obviously every year, but beyond the conference, how are you able to coordinate and build with chapters at other schools? How much interaction is there between chapters? And I'm also wondering if you've been able to establish many connections to organizations beyond the United States as a campus organization based here.
National SJP has always maintained that it is not the overseer of SJPs. You know, they have the autonomy to decide where they go and how they move, and we are there to support. So, you know, in that sense, cross-campus organizing is sort of an ever-evolving sphere within the realm of Palestine student organizing. But especially recently, we recognize that NSJP needs to evolve alongside that, especially considering the power that we have, that sometimes we're not always super keen. Maybe, you know, maybe we just don't recognize it, but we have a lot of power. We don't always name it. Right now, our hope, NSJP's hope, is to become a central hub for students across Turtle Island to engage with things like coordinated campaigns, collective education and trainings, community building initiatives, et cetera. So we're really trying to strengthen our network right now to build this cohesive strategy. And again, like you mentioned, our conferences have always served as sort of that central space for skill sharing and knowledge exchanges. So, you know, campuses are better equipped to build power and build power together, especially across their unique situations and needs. Right now, regional coordination is especially important for us. And we're, you know, steadily working on developing some really like innovative ways to communicate with chapters and for chapters to communicate with each other, so that we can sort of build out that infrastructure that we need to achieve our goals. So, you know, to sum up, those coordination methods have and strategies have really varied over the years, and, you know, have included things like regional conferences. So the Midwest region might host a conference. I think most recently they hosted one in Ann Arbor and they faced a lot of backlash. You know, also regional conferences in the South, stuff like that. So, you know, with over like 220, I think, Palestine Solidarity orgs on college campuses right now, our work is really to develop something more concrete. And that's super vital. To your question sort of about international relationships, you know, in 2020, just this is as an example, the AMED program, AMED program at SFSU, launched a series called Teaching Palestine Pedagogical Praxis and the Indivisibility of Justice. So we have the opportunity to support and engage with like a wide variety of organizations such as Al-Qaws, Adamir, Al-Adab Journal, Adela, and Semidun, and, you know, many more. Those relationships, you know, we're building them. We're continuing to sort of, we're trying to grow closer, expand our network so that we can maintain those ties and be responsive to organizations and the people on the ground in Palestine. We're continuing, again, to move towards a more cohesive student movement in a lot of different ways, and the future looks really promising.
Raphael, thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us today.
Of course, thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start by asking about the most recent conference, which just happened last month. It was the 10th anniversary, and obviously you had to do it virtually. I wanted to talk about how that event went, and I'm also just wondering, logistically, did having to do it virtually for this 10th anniversary make anything more difficult than past conferences, or maybe easier?
Yeah, so the conference went really, really well. We had over 70 chapters and hundreds of students registered, and we were really happy with the turnout. Students that registered and came were also just like super engaged with the programming, and many of them even like reached out to us after, us as well as the other organizations that helped us with this conference and asked us for more information and you know, just asked us a bunch of questions. And so, you know, it's a really challenging time right now for everyone, and folks are experiencing a lot of Zoom fatigue. And so it was really uplifting and you know, just really exciting to see students so engaged, even, you know, at this time. And so, you know, to talk a little bit more about the, I guess, shift to a virtual context. So, you know, as I mentioned, a lot of people are experiencing Zoom fatigue. And so that was definitely a challenge in hosting a virtual conference. But there were also some really, really exciting and, you know, just uplifting parts. So one really exciting thing is that having a virtual conference allowed us to engage chapters transnationally. And so we had students from all over the world register and attend, which, you know, of course, would be much more difficult, if not impossible, in an in-person conference. And then we were also able to connect chapters to grassroots organizations in Palestine. So, for example, we had Al-Qaws come speak at the conference, and that is an opportunity that we would not have gotten otherwise. And so overall, I would say that there were some really big upsides to having the conference virtually.
This conference was titled Safety Through Solidarity, United in Joint Struggle. Can you explain why it was titled that and the significance there?
Yeah. So, you know, after the grassroots mobilizing this summer, we as National SJP identified a need to elevate chapters politically through, you know, political education, and then also organizationally through resources and skill sharing, to really intentionally respond to the political moment that we're living in. So we noticed that while there were so many chapters doing really strong community organizing, so there were a lot of chapters engaging in mutual aid and bond relief and supporting people that were just released after being detained for protesting, there were also chapters who were not really engaged or didn't really feel the need to engage for a number of reasons. For example, maybe like viewing themselves as a more cultural as opposed to political organization. But, you know, because of this, we needed to create a theme, which, you know, the theme, of course, also really heavily informs our programming that allows us to build a shared political foundation for chapters to organize around. So as organizers for Palestine liberation, we know that our safety doesn't come from the police or state institutions. And because we know that Palestine is one component of a larger struggle against imperialism, it was vital that we reaffirmed you know, the idea that we achieve true safety through solidarity, and that the only way to liberation is combating the common enemy through joint struggle.
This was the 10th conference held by Students for Justice in Palestine, but the group has existed since the early 90s, obviously. You're actually undergoing a rebranding, which is detailed on the group's website. Can you kind of explain some of that?
You know, over the past decade, we've seen National SJP do some really incredible work, right? So we've seen things like the Right to Education tours and these like annual conferences, which brought students together and really helped shape and push forward the student movement. However, the student movement at a local level, you know, was and is currently growing really rapidly. And we realized that National SJP was not at the time adequately equipped to meet the student movement's growing needs. So truthfully, we had served as a conference planning body more than anything else. And we knew that in order to support the student movement, we need to really radically restructure and shift our priorities to building out a more fully functioning organization. So following our steering retreat this past March, we decided that we wanted to initiate this process, which, you know, rebranding came out of. So National SJP imagines a student movement that has the political infrastructure to conduct regional, national, and even transnational campaigns. We want to take BDS, for example, beyond the confines of student government votes and to, you know, the Board of Regents or to university administration itself. So given that we know that that the liberation of Palestine is only realized through the liberation of all people globally, we also imagine a student movement equipped with the knowledge and resources to build coalitions and relationships that are rooted in joint struggle with the aim of collective liberation, you know, hence our conference theme this year. So to build this movement, we took steps over the past year towards creating a cohesive centralized structure for the Palestine Solidarity Movement in North America. And as part of this move towards a formalized structure, we initiated three projects. The first is developing a national structure for SJP. And then the second, which goes hand in hand with the first, is co-creating shared principles and values for the SJP network. And then in order to move us closer to those goals, we held consultations in the fall of 2020, where we talked one-on-one with over 60 SJP chapters. And the last project that is part of this rebranding is the rebranding of our image. So we wanted our image to be reflective of the organization that we seek to cultivate. And the redesigning of our image, was the first step towards cohering and unifying the student movement. And so in thinking about the elements that create our image, you know, things such as logo, website, color scheme, even our font, we were really intentional and we tried to choose element or choose characteristics that represented the resolve and determination and commitment to Palestinian liberation that we want the student student movement to embody.
And finally, you've alluded to this in some of your answers already, but just on a wider level, you're obviously a campus organization based in the United States, comprised of college students in the United States, but you're aligned with the demands of Palestinians. Can you just speak to the wider vision there? How do you bridge that gap consistently and make the necessary connections to your mind between the fight going on here over Palestine and the fight going on in Palestine itself for all these decades?
That's a really great question. Thank you so much for asking that. So I have a couple things that I want to say about this, but maybe starting with shifting the framing just a little bit. So, you know, you're absolutely right that SJP is a solidarity-based movement in North America. In being this, our role on campus and in our communities is targeting the ways in which Zionism most concretely materializes. So that is through university investments, police relationships with Israel, anti-BDS laws, the adoption of the IRA definition, you know, all of these manifestations of Zionism that we see. But rather than thinking of it as two movements bridging together, the student movement is really one important sector of a much larger movement for Palestinian liberation. So I guess I don't think it's necessarily a question of needing to make the connection between our work, since the connections are really concrete, but rather it's affirming the notion that student organizing is a really powerful vehicle in combating Zionism and in pushing forward the demands for Palestinian liberation. So, going off of that, in terms of concretely bridging specific demands and calls, National SJP is grounded and guided by Palestinian grassroots organizations and works to connect chapters with their actions. So, for example, we led a three-part virtual political education series with the Palestinian Youth Movement this past summer, which connected students, student organizers in occupied Turtle Island or North America, to student organizers in Palestine. And we discussed things such as abolition and the role of Palestine student organizers in organizing towards abolition, as well as commemorating the Nakba, which the Nakba is a, the catastrophe which befell the Palestinian people in 1948, in which over 800,000 Palestinian refugees were forcibly displaced from their homes because of Zionist militias. In short, we work with Palestinian organizations really closely to connect demands and align students with Palestinian grassroots organizing. But we also see our work and our movement broadly as intimately connected to the Palestine Liberation Movement.
Thanks for listening to our show, a production of MondoWeiss.net. The music is from Sound of Picture. Visit our site to sign up for free daily and weekly newsletters on Palestine, Israel, and related U.S. politics.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Did you get vaccinated?
Not yet, but I will soon.
And which one are you getting?
I'm getting the dance vaccine.
The dance vaccine? Great idea.
Yeah, rehearsing with the girls is what I miss the most.
Well, it's going to be the soccer vaccine for me. I can't wait to see the gang again.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Hey, je vais te laisser. Je dois recevoir mon vaccin Lac des Îles.
Ton vaccin Lac des Îles?
Ben ouais, tu sais comment j'ai hâte d'organiser mon barbecue au chalet avec toute la famille.
Pas bête, ça. Moi, je vais demander mon vaccin restaurant. Ça me manque les soirées improvisées avec les amis.
Hey, moi, j'y vais. Je pense pas qu'il fonctionne contre les retards, ce vaccin-là.
La vaccination nous rapproche de tous ces moments. Suivez la séquence de vaccination prévue dans votre région et prenez rendez-vous à québec.ca/vaccin-COVID. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
If you're in prison, my ass, yeah, I won't get to the